Good evening, everyone. If we could have everyone take their seats, and if you have cell phones, if you could place them on vibrate, we'd appreciate that. I'd like to get started on time this evening and respect your time. We thank you for attending. Good evening. As co-founder of South Fraser on Track, Nathan Pahal and I welcome you to tonight's program entitled Sustainability on the Edge. We would like to thank the Township of Langley Council, Mayor and Council, for a community grant that we received to host this event, and for the vision that they have for a better Langley and a better region. Tonight we'd also like to thank Oregon Metro Councilor Carlotta Collette, who you'll meet later this evening, SFU City Program Director Gordon Price, TransLink Program Manager Moreno Rossi, Township Strategic Planner Jason Chu, and Township Manager of Transportation Engineering Paul Cordero, who have graciously given up their time this evening to be with us. And later our moderator, Councilor Bateman, will introduce the elected officials that are present, and thank you for your attendance. For over the past 5 to 40 years, the community south of the Fraser will see a tremendous growth in population, neighborhoods, and jobs. The desire of South Fraser on Track is for our region to grow in a sustainable manner that builds walkable communities that preserve our public safety, community parks and amenities, and provides a high quality of life for our residents. Of equal, if not greater, importance is our mass transportation options and the planning, which we feel that must be bold, innovative, and improve the quality of our lives. About 4 to 5 years ago, I spent some time in the Township of Langley's Sustainability Charter public events. Maybe many of you were there, and we had a very good turnout one particular Saturday where we spent a Saturday taking a look at sustainability in relation to the upcoming sustainability charter in the township and what that would look like for us and what our communities would look like. It was interesting that the common thread that connected the three areas that we examined that day, which was social, cultural, economic, and environmental, the common thread that connected all of those was the residents in the township saying that we needed efficient, frequent, and reliable public transportation in order for social, cultural, economic, and environmental goals to be reached in the township. This is what you, the people of Langley Township, deem to be of high importance to our future sustainable success. We trust our speakers tonight will spark the process of bold and innovative leadership that sustainability on the edge. It will also become an annual event here in the township, and that we'll gather the best minds and the best speakers to share with us what they're doing and what we can do to piggyback on their success. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our, Mayor Rick Green, Mayor of the Township of Langley, who would like to welcome us on behalf of the township. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you very much, and thanks to everybody for coming. I really congratulate South Fraser on Track for putting together a forum like this. We have, and it's appropriate that it's being held in the Township Hall, because I think the Township are the forerunners in the Valley in terms of dealing with and actually hosting a number of these types of events, and we're very, very interested in sustainable communities. One of the things that I really like everybody to consider when you're looking at the program tonight, and think about our Metro Vancouver Livable Region strategy, which is calling for, just as an example, the Township of Langley to have 170,000 people within 13 to 15 years. That's a 70% increase over what we have today. And think about the connectivity between the Metro Vancouver Livable Region strategy and TransLink. I might suggest that there isn't one. And that is a very serious concern, and I think that we have to really think about that going forward. So I really welcome this type of a forum. We have, as you know, been the leaders of setting up a South of Fraser Community Rail Task Force. And I've just advised Joe the other day that I'm going to recommend at our first meeting that we make as community partners our four community partners, which would be South Fraser on Tracks, Rail for the Valley, Fraser Valley Heritage Rail Society, and which one am I missing? South Fraser Valtac. Thank you. Geez, I'm really going to get blamed now. So those four we're going to ask to be community partners with the elected members, which will be voting members on this Community Rail Task Force. So we're really looking forward to it. We're looking forward to what our panel has to suggest to us and ideas for the future. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Your Worship. My name is Jordan Bateman, and I'm a counselor here in the Township of Langley, and it's my pleasure to moderate tonight. But we're going to start with it's a classic thing in events like this. You have to introduce the politicians. You know, the politicians, we don't really like it. We don't really like it, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, but, you know, we're going to do it anyways. And we'll start with a couple of MLEs who are here. One who's come all the way from Saanich South, Lana Popham, is here. And one who's come all the way from Surrey, it's not quite as impressive, but Surrey Newton MLA Harry Baines is here. As well, we've met His Worship Rick Green, Mayor of the Township of Langley, and several other councillors from the township are here with us. Grant Ward is here. Charlie Fox is in the back there hiding out. Ferguson is to the left wondering where the snacks are. So, we also are very fortunate to have two Langley City Councillors here. Mayor Peter Fassbender, who's been a great supporter of South Fraser on Track, wanted to be here, had another event, so he couldn't be here, but he sent the Deputy Mayor Jack Arnold and City Councillor Rudy Stordeboom in his place. Right, and I think that's everything. There were a couple other regrets. MP Mark Warwa would have loved to have been here, but couldn't make it. And the two local MLAs, Rich Coleman and Mary Polak, couldn't make it either, but they have sent a staff person, Kathy Gibbs. And if you know anything about Langley, it's really Kathy who's doing all the work. So now we're going to get into the program. So it's my honor to introduce our first speaker tonight, Moreno Rossi, and he's the Program Manager for Transport Infrastructure Development at TransLink. And Moreno's great because they've worked both sides of the street. Moreno's an urban planner with extensive municipal experience in long-range and development planning, as well as several years of experience in the development industry and in engineering, planning and engineering. Moreno's work has included projects that propose significant revisions to municipal street standards to better reflect the needs of pedestrians, cyclists, and residents. He has also led land use planning studies that focused on density, mixed use, transportation, and urban design as the tools for achieving sustainability objectives. And as we all know, if we want transit-oriented development here in Langley, we need to get TransLink on board. So we're very pleased to have Moreno Rossi come and speak and share his vision for this community. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me here. I'm really pleased to be here, and we're always pleased to come and talk about what it takes to get this fit between transit and the communities we serve. And I lead a group of about eight people that works towards that cause. We work at designing passenger facilities better meet the needs of passengers, provide a better fit into the community, and also partner with a number of communities in terms of developing the area plans around a lot of our transit facilities. The presentation tonight is going to look at some of the challenges we face in terms of retrofitting what has largely been a region built around the car and retrofitting it for transit. We'll talk a little bit about what it takes to actually build transit-oriented communities. there we have a number of examples of work that TransLink is doing towards getting to transit-oriented communities, and then some lessons learned in the process. In terms of the challenges, we need to think about the key objective in terms of getting to a transit-oriented community, and the kind of community we need is one where walking is easy. Every transit trip starts and ends with a walk, and we need to do a much better job of accommodating pedestrians. Today, a lot of the region is built around the car, so destinations are far apart, they're spread out. Roads operate at relatively high speed, and the environment generally is one that is hostile towards pedestrians. And it's an environment that's also really difficult and expensive to operate transit in, or high-quality transit in. Okay, thanks. This little graphic tries to explain just some of the difficulties around that. The darker colors on the graphic identify the concentration of jobs and people in the region, and so you'll see that in the Vancouver Peninsula, you get the darker colors where you get a higher concentration of jobs and people, and then you get spots of density, I guess, arranged around the region. When you look at how people get to work on a daily basis, in the downtown peninsula, 67% either walk, bike, or take transit. As soon as you move outside of that, and that's where we have a considerable amount of density, a considerable number of jobs located. When you move outside of that into the general Vancouver area, the number drops off to about 48%. And when you look at the balance of the region, it drops down to almost a third, to 27%. There's a very obvious correlation between the mode people use to get to work and the distribution of jobs and density. This illustrates pretty clearly, I think these two images illustrate pretty clearly the difference between the two type of environments that we need to create. One is very auto-oriented. There is a bus stop, a bench located on an island, and the pedestrians, people arriving to and leaving that bus stop, need to negotiate their way through really an environment that's really accommodating cars. On the right, pedestrians are close to services, close to shops, generous sidewalks, a much healthier environment for pedestrians. So what's involved in terms of building these communities, building transit-oriented communities? There are places that facilitate a decreased reliance on driving by creating greater density, by creating more diversity of use, creating pedestrian-friendly places, and creating uses within walking distance of frequent transit. They're just really pedestrian-oriented communities connected by transit. And the benefits are significant. It's a lot more cost-effective to provide transit to these kind of communities. It's more cost-effective to provide high-quality transit. And you generally have a much happier place to be in as a pedestrian. So we talk about really the five D's that are critical in terms of achieving successful transit-oriented communities and successful transit. The first is destination. You need to be on the way. You need to be able to connect the destinations and to locate uses along the way. The best transportation plan is actually a land use plan. We talk a lot about the distance to transit. It's critical that transit be within walking distance of where people live and work. In general rule of thumb we follow is that in higher order transit, like rapid transit, people are generally willing to walk up to 800 meters to get to a station. To a bus stop, probably around 400 meters. Those numbers are just general rules. They can vary quite a bit depending on the kind of environment people experience when they're taking that trip. 800 meters can seem like a lot longer in a more hostile, unfriendly environment. It can seem quite pleasant it can seem much shorter in a much more pleasant environment. Density is key. We need to focus a lot more density around our transit hubs. Density concentrated at the transit hubs, and it can taper out to lower densities as it transitions away from the transit facilities. We need diversity in use. There needs to be a rich mix of uses. There needs to be a diversity in housing type that accommodates many types of residents. And in combination, these things allow transit to serve a variety of trip types. And design needs to be is an incredibly important consideration. The environment that the pedestrians experience needs to be a quality environment, well designed. It needs to provide decent connections, short connections to a variety of uses to transit facilities, and it needs to mitigate the impact of the car. So at TransLink, we're taking a much more strategic approach in terms of trying to achieve these goals. On the supply side, we're developing a frequent transit network, and on the demand side, we're looking for partnerships. We've entered into partnerships with municipalities to develop transit-oriented development plans in and around our facilities. The frequent transit network it describes transit services, all sorts of transit services, all types of transit services that provide a service with a minimum frequency of every 15 minutes throughout the day, 7 days a week. And this network plan becomes the basis for a conversation that we can have around how we can organize land or coordinate land use and transit service. An incredibly, obviously incredibly important part of that frequent transit network is the rapid transit component. It requires a long lead time to understand the exact need of that service. It's incredibly capital intensive, and so we've started a number of studies that are looking at different corridors, different networks that will allow us to understand what the regional priorities should be moving forward. At the facility level, we've entered into a number of partnerships with cities and municipalities to look at what we can do to better integrate our facilities with the neighborhoods. And we've also worked with the cities to then look at the neighborhoods to see what sort of changes can be brought about in the neighborhood to actually support those facilities. A very good example, we think, of that sort of project is the Broadway Commercial Transit Village Plan, which we developed with the City of Vancouver. And we've actually implemented the first phase of that, which was a significant improvement to the Broadway station that saw that station opened up and connected to the neighborhood to the south, and just made the station much more transparent, much more open, much more open to the neighborhood. It's also has a land use plan that's associated with it that shows how density can be augmented in a significant way in and around the station, again, to support the facility. At Surrey Central, we also developed a new urban structure plan, land use plan around the Surrey Central Station. The station today is characterized by a big super block structure with lots of surface parking, very low density development. A new plan has been developed for the area with the city that actually looks at taking the existing bus service that is operated out of the exchange, moving that to an on-street service, and then converting that land and much of the land around it to significantly higher densities, bringing in a number of civic facilities. The city has, I think, already demonstrated significant commitment to the plan with their plans to actually move their entire city hall to the center as well as to build a new public library at the center. That will be the catalyst for then reorganizing the transit service around the center as well. At Newton Town Center, again, through a partnership with the city there, we have an existing exchange, which is the yellow dot on the left-hand diagram. The exchange is actually one of our better exchanges, well integrated into the community. However, there are a lot of urban design issues around there where existing facilities turn their back on the exchange and create some issues around the exchange. There's a lot of land that's actually that could contribute to increase densities to serve the exchange. So we've developed a plan with the city to relocate the exchange and free up the existing exchange land so that they can actually address some of those urban design problems they have around the existing facilities, and then created a plan around a new exchange that actually looks at really significant densities around the facility to support it and integrates the exchange really well with development right in and around the exchange. We're also taking a more active role with our land holdings around these facilities where historically we've just simply sold off residual lands after development of a facility, or sometimes just leased the space needed for the facility back. We're actually going to look at these residual lands and how they can be developed, and look at opportunities for partnerships with how they can be developed in a way that actually supports the facility that we're putting in place, and trying to capture back some of the value that the facilities bring to the neighborhood. In terms of the lessons learned through these processes, pedestrians need to be prioritized. Walkable urban design is crucial to optimizing transit investment. We need to integrate land use and transit infrastructure at the outset. One of the difficulties we're having with some of these retrofits is that they're very, very expensive. Fixing mistakes is very expensive. Getting it right from the get-go is a lot more cost-effective. And finally, be on the way. The best transportation is a land use plan. We need to really work hard at coordinating our transit planning with our land use plans. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rossi. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Gordon Price, who is the director of the City Program at Simon Fraser University, no stranger to the ongoing discussion in the blogosphere about urban planning and transportation issues in the Lower Mainland. In fact, once on his blog, Joe, he called me charming. So, Mr. Price is one of my favorite bloggers for that reason alone. And on a serious note, if you've never been to his website, pricetags.ca, it's worth going to. He takes a look at other cities around the world, puts them into a PDF, kind of almost like a photo book, and kind of looks at the very, some would say, excruciating minutiae of urban design, but points out things that are very small but very simple ways to make communities more livable. And that's been a big help to me as I've been exploring some of these issues. Mr. Price is a former city councillor in Vancouver, BC. He served on the board of the Greater Vancouver Regional District and survived the Great Translink Wars of the early 2000s. Barely. He's won a number of awards. Right now he sits on Mayor Robertson's Greenest City Action Team. He's also on the boards of the Sightline Institute and the International Center for Sustainable Cities. I could go on and on, but I'd rather have him talk. So, Mr. Price.
Very nice. That was charming. Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. I'm a West End boy. Going south of False Creek is like a trip to the suburbs. So I come with a different way of looking at the world, including my region. But as director of the city program, we recognize that if we're not south of the Fraser, we're not relevant. What does it say on the trucks of an adjacent municipality? The future is here? Future lives here. Yeah, that's true. Population growth, for one thing. Well, that alone would be sufficient. But in my opinion, more than that, if we don't do this right, it frankly doesn't really matter much what the city of Vancouver does. We're finished as far as any fundamental change to the character of our community, I would say, for the next generation. I exaggerate only a little. But what happens here, in my opinion, yours as well, I suspect, is far more important. So I want to give you a kind of framework of thinking about what it is that you face. My opinion, obviously, but if I'm persuasive, I think you will agree that it fundamentally addresses the conundrum that you are in. Now, they gave me 15 minutes to do this. And even for an ex-politician, that's about the time it takes to clear your throat. So I'm going to have to move along here, and I'm going to call on you to give me about a 2 or 3 minute warning. Eh? Down the lights a little here. Now, with with 15 minutes, you know, they say when you're giving a presentation, you should leave people with three things that they can take away. We ain't got time for that. I'm going to leave you with one. In fact, I'm going to narrow it down to one word. If you remember nothing else about what I say, remember this word. Now, this word actually, you won't find it in a dictionary today, but you would have found it in a newspaper in the 1920s. Because it represented the interests that align of the automobile clubs, the dealerships, and the manufacturers. And look, this is not a tirade against the car or a conspiracy theory. This reflects a fundamental reality about that time and place when the automobile was emerging as a very popular form of transportation, and we had to deal with some real issues when you introduce a fast-moving, single-powered vehicle into the dense cities that existed at that time. And the interests came together for what another academic called the social reconsideration of the street. We had to look at our cities differently. And we did. We had to accommodate the car. The way we built had to recognize the fact that most people would choose, once they were rich enough, to own automobiles. And that's one of the great achievements of our culture, is that we have made the average working person rich enough to be able to own their own form of transportation that gets them to their own single-family house. Or at least that's that sense that we have. The Canadian dream, the American dream, the Australian dream, the Chinese dream, the Indian dream, any culture rich enough will do this, is doing this. And so wherever you go, for the latter half of the 20th century, you will see fundamentally the same urban form. Auto-dependent urban form. I take shots around the world and my own province, and here's a few collections of images. I want you to just take a look, because what you are looking at is the world that most of us live in. It's the one we are currently constructing, as we have been for the last half century. This one just a few weeks ago. These are the real economic hearts of our community, at least as far as retail is concerned, and to a great extent with variations where industry is. Industrial parks, college campuses, single occupancy, single family residential tract subdivisions, shopping centers. And it all basically assumes that almost everyone is going to drive almost all the time to get almost everywhere. Is there anyone in here for whom that is not true? It's one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. What, about 10%? A little less. That's high. And it reflects the choice that people who would want to be interested in this kind of thing, you know, would be. There would be more variation than you would find if you simply go out anywhere around, oh, I don't know, maybe a 10-kilometer radius here. It's the world in which the fundamental form is shaped by one critical criterion. Form will follow parking. I can go into your bylaws and your manuals, and once I know what your parking ratios are and your land values, assuming that people will have to build surface parking, I can get a pretty good idea of what your community is going to have to look like. It's not going to be a choice. Once you've determined where the parking is, what the parking ratio is, how it will relate to the buildings, the arterials, the rest is detail. And frankly, not very significant detail. Basically, it's the big sign out front and the corporate colors. That's about as much as the architects kind of get to do. And here is more or less the considerations that go into designing for motordom. Things are going to be big and simple. Go to your zoning map, you're going to find big blocks of color. And most things will be squared out. The sites will be flattened, more or less paved, maybe planted, right? But we're going to start with more or less a blank slate. It's going to be pretty much low density and single use. Now, we are getting better at doing more mixes, and certainly densities are going up. But fundamentally, motordom is oriented around the idea that things will be low density and single use, and land values are going to have to reflect that, and it will be all auto-oriented. It simply has to be. I'll be real about that. It has to be. So, why? Well, because it's all in here. 1942, first edition of the IETE Engineering Handbook. You know, there are a number of handbooks like this, but fundamentally what they say is you've got to do it this way. You as a mayor and a councillor aren't going to have much choice about that. You know, professionals put this in front of you and say, look, this is basically what you've got to go along with, because if you don't, what will get built won't be safe. And if it's not safe, this city's going to be liable. And frankly, safety and liability ends the discussion. That's pretty much it. You've got to go along with this, and there's good reason for this, because this does produce an extraordinary infrastructure that by and large is safe. You know, the great achievement of the traffic engineering profession is the number of lives they have saved. It's one of the things they can be proudest of. Yes, we do see a lot of deaths and injuries from automobiles, but frankly, nothing like what it was when the automobile was first introduced and what you see around the world where they don't have this kind of demand that we build safe infrastructure. So that's what we have to do, and we do it. It's dedicated to the efficient, free, and rapid flow of traffic, and by and large, it works pretty darn well. Until it doesn't. Because you see, there's a big difference between designing your urban region and your city to accommodate the car, which you simply have to do, and designing the region so it's only for the car. And all the other choices basically have been driven out. Pardon the pun. See, motordom overdid it. That's my main criticism of it. Not that it doesn't do what it does well, but it's all it does, and it drove out choice. And in doing so, it has made us vulnerable. I'm going to talk a little bit more about what I mean by that. But it always has. Motordom never did achieve the efficient, free, and rapid flow of traffic because it could never solve the problem of, quote, congestion. Well, let me ask this question. I always do, so here's a chance for you to see if you can answer this one. Give me a good example. I want one place that you can think of, let's go for North America here, where they've successfully solved or even just dealt with congestion by building more roads and bridges. Now, I'm looking for one good example. I'm going to put a qualification on this. It's the place we want to be more like. Okay. Give me a few. Portland? Would you say Portland solved traffic congestion by building more? OK. councillor, Metro councillor here, doesn't agree with you on that one. I'm going to go with her. They say Houston. Anyone been to Houston?
No.
Hell to drive. You know, Houston puts, I've heard, about $1 billion a year into traffic infrastructure, and I think that might be actually a model that you could say has dealt to some degree with it, right? Now, is it the model that we want to be more like? Could we even be? Remember, they're effectively a prairie city. They can grow out in every direction. Anyone got anyone else? Anyone else? Now, look, let's think about that for a moment here. Because this is probably the biggest single infrastructure commitment that we make, and we have spent trillions of dollars on this. And we don't have one working example of success. And we're doing more of it. Right? We're doing more of it. And we don't have one example of success. This is the dilemma of motordom. It has driven out the other choices to the point where we only have one left, and even though it doesn't work, we have to do more of it. Because we like this. This is probably the best quality of life human beings have ever had on this planet. And what it's been based upon, and let me say on behalf of government, may I? That we have done a fabulous job of delivering this high quality of life. Call it suburban, I don't mean that to be a pejorative. And it's been based upon this: cheap, secure energy, abundant service land. That's basically the business that we're in, isn't it? We've got to provide service land. And a continuous flow of safe water. And for those of us who sit on the regional board and are part of the water district, you take that for granted. We do such a good job, you don't even think about it. You know how much water costs you wholesale? Let's put a liter bottle here on the table, and let's multiply it by 1,000. What's the price today? Last when I was on the board, it was about 15 cents. Right? To have safe and abundant water on that scale, so cheap we don't even meter it, so cheap you don't even think about the price of it, and so basic you can't even have civilization without it, is I wouldn't call it a miracle, but it comes pretty close. Low-cost insured money. Don't even think about that as a social program, but it is, and the technologies that make it all work. We've done such a good job of this that we now see it as an entitlement. Right? Every generation assumes that they, in a sense, are entitled to it, and government is committed to trying to make that happen. The problem is, and this is where I think we are at this moment in time, this commitment, all of this assumptions that we have, this is where we get into vulnerability. Cheap, secure energy, right? Now, this is a fascinating chart. Now, it's probably a little too small. But basically, starting from the point where we discovered oil on the quantity sufficient to make it a motor fuel for transportation to today, pretty much, look what happened. In the early days, you see this gyrating price. This is in real dollars, right? Until when Vancouver starts, 1886. And for most of the 20th century, it's flat and cheap. So my generation, and my parents' generation, and the generation before that have lived in a world where oil is practically like water. In fact, it's still cheaper than bottled water. But more importantly, the price hasn't gone up and down. We've been able to assume that it will be there down the street in a pump that we can put into our vehicles, and we'd hardly have to think about the cost of it. Until you get to 1972 and 3, and again in 79, right? The oil crises. And then look what happens. Through the 90s, it flattens out again. That's the era of the sport utility vehicle. Those are the Clinton years, right? So we don't have to think about it again. And then about 2005, the price of oil spikes. And then in 2006, you begin to see the creeks. And by 2007, things start to go badly wrong. And by 2008, the world's financial system collapses. I don't have to exaggerate that, do I? Now, I think those two dots are fairly close together. I think when oil was no longer seen to be cheap and secure, and the mega mansion and the three-car garage and the sport utility vehicle could no longer assume to increase in value every year. The basis of the asset in which all that leverage debt was based, bad things happened. So I'm going to ask you this question too. What do you think the rest of our lives are going to be like? Like the period from 1886 to 1972, flat and secure and effectively affordable? Or do you think it's going to gyrate? I think we're going to be living in an age of volatility, an age of peak oil, right? Now, lots of debates about peak oil. I only want to make this one point. We're effectively, as far as those assumptions of cheap and secure, not that oil won't be available. We're already there. So we're into this age of volatility upon which the basis of our way of life and certainly our transportation system has been based. What's the alternative? What's the choice? Well, you've already seen it. Miranda did a really good job of laying it all out for you. We know how to do that. But the basis of it is, as far as a sustainable region is concerned, is this one about transportation choice. Now, that little formula there, I made up. It's just to tell you, you can't take one of those things and pull it apart. Right? You just can't say, well, we'll increase the densities, we'll have more mix, and we'll try and do a good design on it. But basically, motordom's going to go on. No. Sorry, it doesn't work like that. You've got to have the transportation choice. And what that means is you have to have five practical choices that you can offer people. And what do you think number one is? Walking? No.
Drive.
Yeah, absolutely. Car. Do you think you can go out there, Mr. Politician, and tell people, we're forcing you out of your car. Good luck. Nah, car's number one. Taxi and car sharing, that's just another way of buying a car trip on a per-trip basis. Okay? Taxi is really important. And in my neighborhood, car sharing, very realistic. Transit of all kinds, bicycles and scooters and everything else you can think of that I think people are going to come up with, and then finally, walking. Right? Now, you put all those together and you give people those choices, you get to choose. And they can more or less solve your transportation problem on their own without you having to do a lot of top-down, and you know how well that's going to go down, a lot of top-down instructions or tell your planners to do something that they... that's not fair to them. And it's going to help solve one of those real dilemmas that, frankly, we just simply haven't come to terms with yet, how we're going to pay for all of this. Back to that. So that isn't going to cut it. That doesn't really practically give people choice, and you know why? Because no one wants to be that guy on the bicycle picking up bottles on the side of 200th Street. Right? Anyone aspire to his lifestyle? That's not a practical choice. Class counts. Image. Social acceptability. Status. If you're not taking that into account, although it's difficult to talk about, not real. So for all of those choices, now are we going backwards?
Actually, no. I probably used up my 15 minutes. So I'm going to go right to the nub of it.
What I have in between, by the way, is to show you all the good examples I got. Negative thing, right? We are really good at this. You know, the world's going to show up here and the pretty pictures will all be of False Creek and Cole Harbor. The cameras and the reporters should be coming out and taking a look at how good we do suburban density. So I think some of this stuff is as good as I've ever seen anywhere. Port Moody building this stuff even before transit comes up. Mixed use, high density, right? The car disappears, but it's part of it. On the expectation of the Evergreen Line, this is a real achievement, and this is nice stuff. People out there like it. The biggest construction hole in the Lower Mainland, right across the street from Newport Village, now Souter Burke, right? Great stuff. And when we build this, when we deliver the frequent transit network and the transit, and we do the designs that Moreno has showed, this is good. This wins the best awards on the planet, Surrey Central City. And here's what I think is the real tragedy, and I use that word advisedly.
we're not going to do this. When the TransLink board made that decision that they're going to find $130 million just to keep things as they are, just to hang on, that locked us in for the next 5 years. Nothing serious in the way of new transit is going to happen, I think, for the least half a decade. So this stuff's great, and it'll work, and people will use it. And we're not going to do it. We decided politically we're not going to do it. The truckers won. BC Trucking Association makes the point. We're spending a lot on transit. We're taxing people like truckers. Haven't increased, by and large, transit's share. Right? Stop doing that. Well, we are. We put a cap on it. And what are we going to do? We're going to do this. We're going to build them their roads and their bridges. It's underway. That construction's done. It's opened up. We're locking the next generation into motordom. That's the decision that we've made. And there's nothing we can do about that. That's going to go now for the next at least decade to shape you. Once that freeway opens up with those great new interchanges and that incredible new bridge that they're going to build that fits very nicely into Golden Ears, which I voted for, and Pitt River, the message couldn't be clearer. If you're a business person, would you want to build any less parking spaces than what the bylaws require? If you're a homeowner, would you be thinking, maybe I don't need that second car? If you're a student, can you imagine getting by with just a TransLink pass if you live anywhere around here? Well, that would just frankly be stupid because we're spending billions to make sure that you don't have to do that. You'll be able to drive. We're going to hold out that promise that we may, quote, deal with congestion. So that's done. There's nothing we can do about that. And I appreciate what Moreno was saying, but they don't have any money for that. So it isn't going to happen unless something changes. And I don't see it. Because if I was sitting in Victoria and thinking TransLink comes to me and says, put on a vehicle levy or a new parking tax, that's political suicide. And that's the way the NDP saw it when DeSantis killed the vehicle levy. It's the way the Liberals saw it when they killed the parking tax. So I don't see it. And that's really, really gloomy, isn't it? Yeah, it is. So get used to it, right? Because that's reality. And if we are going to do anything different, it's going to be incremental. And above all, it's going to be because we prepare ourselves for what I guess I'm going to have to call the crises that will come that will fundamentally allow a new political opportunity to occur. I can't predict what it is. I can't predict when it will occur. All I can say now is that basically that seems to be the only choice. Now, there is this little island in there where we didn't build the freeways, and we basically have those five practical choices, and it works pretty well, and that's what we're going to show the world during the Olympics, and people will say, "Ooh, that's very good." As I say, the future's here. So, what is your future? At this point, I think it's going to be the San Fernando Valley. Grid of roads, 1 mile squares, arterials, freeways that basically edge, right? All the infrastructure will be built out, and motordom will fundamentally fill in the pieces. That seems to be the way we go. And then there will be these islands, Surrey Center, Langley City, possibly Cloverdale, maybe, we'll see. We're going to do our best to build these alternatives for people, to give them an idea of what life can be like, to give them some more choices. We're going to do a good job of it. They will be little islands. And fundamentally, most of us are going to have to find a way to think about resilience so that we can handle the consequences when our stable systems and our expectations probably go through seismic change. And I think the job of people in this room is to give people some hope and some choices. But if the expectation is our job is fundamentally to live in a world of motordom that can't be changed, I think that's going to be tough to do. So the challenge that I feel we have, and now we're into basically the region as a whole, and let's include the province and the federal government in that too, because we're all going to have to combine resources for it, is to take this moment and think strategically about where we're going to be in about 5 years, maybe 10, because that's the only realistic time frame we have to work in. So for tracks and for the municipalities here, that's where I think we're going to be. A time frame of 5 years, hopefully so that nothing so traumatic will occur. Well, even then, you know, I just don't think we can assume that. My prediction would be this is going to be one of the more turbulent decades in frankly, a long time. But, again, no politician runs without offering people some hope. So we have to recognize realistically the world we live in. We have to look at some choices and opportunities that we can, and then in a 5 to 10 year time frame, think about where we can be that will allow us to go through the kind of change that I think we are probably going to have to face. And the really good news, if there is, and I believe there is some here, is that we're good at it. When we do it the best that there is that I've seen, at least in my experience. So thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Brings us to our keynote speaker, Councillor Collette, who would argue that Portland does it just a little better than Vancouver, but we can have that debate, and Seattle would jump in that mix as well. Councillor Carlotta Collette was appointed to the Metro Portland Council in November 2007 and elected in November 2008. She chairs Metro's Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, which determines priorities and projects slated for funding with federal transportation dollars in the region. Wouldn't it be nice to have federal transportation dollars in the region? Collette is also the council lead on the high-capacity transit system plan, planning for the region's next 30 years of investments in light rail, commuter rail, regional streetcars, and bus rapid transit. She serves on the Lake Oswego to Portland Transit Project Steering Committee, the Sunrise Project Policy Review Committee, and previously served on the Portland to Milwaukee Light Rail Project Steering Committee. She has 30 years of experience addressing complex infrastructure, livability, and natural resource issues. She's part of a chair of a community college board of education. I don't know how you also have time to be a published photographer, writer, and gardener, prize-winning gardener, but that is impressive to me since my lawn hasn't been mowed since late July. Anyways. Very impressive. Thank you for coming all the way from Portland, and we look forward to hearing you talk now on Sustainability on the Edge.
Thank you. It's always interesting to follow Gordon because, in fact, it is kind of a mutual admiration society between the Portland metro region and the Vancouver metro region. We bring our local leaders up here, and people from up here go down to Portland, and then you bring me up here. So it's very exciting to be here. And as Gordon pointed out, the challenges are, I would say, extreme. I think that driving around the Langleys today has given me some insights into how your community was built, and a lot of it is what Gordon showed in the slides. So I'm hoping I can leave you with a little bit of message of hope of how we've built our community, and it's somewhat different. Although we have some similar examples, I'm sure I could show. I'm not going to. Let me first talk a little bit about how our region is a little bit different than yours. And like yours, however, we are on a big river. We are actually at the confluence of the Columbia River and the Willamette River. We're a little bit more contained geographically because we have the Cascade Mountains on one side and the coastal mountain range on the other, so that when we look at sprawling, we really kind of come up against our two mountain ranges, and that's helped us to think as a region in a way. And then we're somewhat confined by state land use laws in Oregon that ordered us basically to create an urban growth boundary, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But landscape-wise, we're very similar to, I think, you have more grandeur here, your mountains seem higher, and your lakes seem bluer and cleaner, But we have mountains and we have rivers and we have a few lakes, and so in some ways we're similar. Our metro council is different, however. We are actually elected to be on the metro council. I'm the only metro councilor who actually was formerly a city councilor. We have a committee, one of our major advisory committees, actually we have two committees, one on transportation and one on land use, that is more similar probably to Vancouver Metro in that it's made up of people who also are elected leaders, mayors, city councilors, county commissioners, and some of the department heads of like transportation departments, environmental departments. We're unique in that we have the enviable role of doing land use and transportation planning together. And I think that's one of the things that Moreno pointed out, is that really the best transportation plan is a land use plan. We have responsibility to do them together, and that gives us a great opportunity, but also an enormous challenge, as you can imagine. We also have a number of other sort of strange roles. We were empowered by our voters to buy up open space and natural areas. And so we now own and manage about 12,000 acres, and we are rapidly accumulating more. We just bought our biggest parcel, which was over 1,000 acres, for one contiguous piece of habitat that we were very excited to buy. We coordinate all the solid waste and recycling in the metro region. And we own and operate the Oregon Zoo, the Oregon Convention Center, the Expo Center, and we operate the Performing Arts Centers, which are owned by the City of Portland. And then when Multnomah County, one of our three counties, couldn't maintain their cemeteries and their parks and their boat launches and golf courses anymore, they gave them to us. And this is sort of a pattern in the metro region, is that when the zoo was failing, they said, well, let Metro fix it. So they gave it to us, and it now is a very viable institution. When the Pioneer Cemeteries couldn't be maintained by the county, they gave them to us. So we have the strange role of operating 14 Pioneer Cemeteries, along with land use and transportation planning and a number of other things. So we are an elected body, we're visible and accountable, and for my money, our charter gives us the best job description anybody could have, and that's that we do the policy making and planning to preserve and enhance the quality of life and the environment for ourselves and future generations. When I saw that was part of the charter, I thought, I have landed in the best job. I mean, it is truly what one can dedicate one's life to. However, it's not easy. Within our boundaries, we have three counties, and not all of the counties are within our urban growth boundary. In fact, my county, the district that I serve, most of the county is rural, and it's outside of the metro district. We have 25 cities within our district, and a number of large, semi-urban, and sometimes somewhat rural, unincorporated areas that are also part of our district. The district is about 250,000 acres. And because we are elected on our own, we have to be partners with our local governments, because the local governments don't sit on the Metro Council. They sit on advisory committees, so we work very closely with all of our cities and county governments. We work with them on our regional transportation and land use plan, but we also help them with their versions, their local transportation plans. Our primary role from the beginning was coordinating the distribution of federal transportation dollars. And there are institutions like us all around the country, except that they're not elected. And they're called metropolitan planning organizations, and their whole role, for the most part, is transportation planning, figuring out how to distribute the federal transportation funds in a way that protects clean air. That's kind of where the metropolitan planning organizations got their start. Ours is substantially different from the rule of thumb. There's actually several of these MPOs, they're called, in Oregon. But again, ours is the only one that has this broad spectrum of responsibility. We really see I have one slide out of order here, sorry. Okay. our major role is really regional urban planning, and that's why it does include things like planning for the parks and the open spaces and connectivity of trails and transportation and land use. And in 1982, as part of this whole regional urban planning, we had our first light rail plan. And I'll tell you a little history about this because it really plays into what Gordon was talking about. There was a plan to build a grid of new freeways around the Portland metropolitan region. And the first one was laid out, and it went right through one of our most populated, most successful, most walkable, most just wonderful neighborhoods, all the way from downtown Portland out to Mount Hood. It was called the Mount Hood Freeway. And because of that plan, Portland's neighborhoods got organized and protested it. And it got all the way to the stage of it got federal funding to build this Mount Hood Freeway, it was called. And the city council responded to the neighborhoods and canceled the plan, took the money from the feds, and built the first light rail system. So we have a history of really trying to do right by our neighborhoods. How we got started, in 1979, the metro region was, 1973, let me step back a step, land use laws in Oregon required every community to create an urban growth boundary. And it was because, really, Oregon was primarily an agricultural state. Our principal sources of income were ag lands and forestry, and urban sprawl was eating up more and more of this very prime farmland and forest. So we were ordered to create urban growth boundaries around every community, and the one around the metropolitan boundary was put in place in 1979. And the cool thing about our urban growth boundaries, that even though we've expanded it, our council has to look ahead and make sure that we keep having enough land within the urban growth boundary. So even though since 1979 we've added about 25,000 or so acres to the urban growth boundary, 95% of the development since 1979 has occurred within that original 1979 boundary. And that's enabled us to build these strong communities that both of our previous speakers talked about are the necessity in order for us to get away from a motordom kind of culture. In 1995, we did a process similar to what Vancouver is doing right now. It was called our 2040 Growth Concept Plan. And we looked at how could, I mean, are we getting it right? We really went out to the public. And I think what was amazing about this process was that we engaged around 19,000 people participated in this public process. And we looked at, should we just keep kind of sprawling out? Does the mouse work? Yeah. So this was sort of, do we gradually have what we call a soft urban growth boundary and let sprawl happen sort of organically? Do we have what we call kind of a hard crust? We have a lot of concentration at the edge and have most of the new urban growth be at the edge? Do we have sort of a hybrid where people are moving, we're focusing back in, but there's still expansion at the edge? Or do we hold a firm edge and let all the growth happen in the neighboring cities? That was not a very popular one with our neighboring cities, I can tell you. We ended up with kind of a combination, and we call it our regional 2040 growth plan. And contrary to a lot of public opinion in the metro region, we do not have this tattooed on our backsides. We have memorized it for the most part. And what we do with the 2040 growth vision is that this is the central core of Portland. This is the central core of Vancouver, which is not part of our region technically, but we collaborate a lot with the U.S. Vancouver. Let's see, where's my mouse here? I've lost. There it is. Okay, so these are called regional centers, this sort of mid-size circle. They're all around our region. And they were intended to be where the high-capacity transit makes the connections. So we have these. There's seven of these around our region. And then there are smaller town centers that are a little harder to see, but they're the smaller, mauve-looking circles. And these are other communities that we want to have urban density, but they might not necessarily get high-capacity transit. In the Portland streetcar plan, a lot of those will get streetcars. So there will be a lot of concentration still of other modes of transportation. And it enabled us, because we were building this high-capacity transit system to these large regional centers, it enabled us to also focus our other investments in those centers. Right now we're engaged and we're hopefully wrapping up a process. Every 5 years, as I said, Metro has to look ahead and decide how much more land we may need based on population and employment land expansion. And this time around, the Metro councillors, my colleagues, were sort of tired of being the seven people who stand up in front of the region and get fired at about either making it too big or too small. So they went to the legislature and they got the counties in the fighting ring with us. And now we're doing the process of a very different approach. And at the same time, we're not just looking at land use. We decided to do our regional transportation plan at the same time that we're doing the land use planning. And we went out and did an infrastructure analysis of if we grow, where should we grow based on the sewer, water systems, all of the infrastructure that you have to build if you're going to go outside your existing network of cities. And we asked these questions all around our region. And the first thing that we did as we started asking these questions was we said, so what are the outcomes you want as a region? When you get all your local officials in the room together, what do you all agree to? And you know, there were a number of things that fell off the plate because everybody didn't agree to them. But these are the ones that people agreed to. They said this region should have a sustained economic competitiveness and prosperity. You can't argue with that. Safe and reliable transportation choices, not just cars. Vibrant, walkable communities, that was really key. Minimal contributions to global warming, clean air, clean water. We've had a big emphasis on this historically in our region. And then the benefits and burdens of growth shared equitably throughout the region. And that is probably going to be the toughest one to deliver because as you experienced here in Vancouver and here in Langley even, the more confined you make your footprint, the higher cost the housing. And what you find is that we have the term in the U.S. is you drive till you qualify. You drive out from the center until the housing is cheap enough for you to qualify for a loan. And in the old days, that's all you thought about was, okay, I can pay my mortgage out here. Now, and at least the way we consider it, is we combine the housing cost with the transportation cost. And we say that combined cost is what it costs to live in our region. And if we can make it affordable for somebody to be closer to cheaper transportation, then you've got a better solution than forcing people to live out in the suburbs where they can't afford to drive to their jobs and they don't have a good form of transportation. So it all has to come in together in our desired regional outcomes. So as we went forward with this planning process, it's been very interesting. What we've done is we've worked with the local governments and asked each of them to tell us what their aspirations are. Now, in Oregon, every city has to have a comprehensive plan, but that gets down into a lot of details. We said to people, just give us, you know, a sort of a thumbnail version of what your aspirations are. How do you want to urbanize? How many people do you think your community can handle? How do you think you'll handle transportation? Not every city came through. I think 19 cities responded, and those cities helped us shape a picture of what the land use potential of the region might be over the next 50 years. And that's our planning horizon. We're now planning for a 50-year horizon, not just a 20-year horizon. We also looked at regionally what the population growth would be. We are expecting about 1 million more people in the next 20 to 30 years and probably close to doubling the population over the 50 to 60-year planning horizon. We looked at employment lands, and, of course, all of this means we looked at traffic. And what we found is that the only way we can really manage the likely congestion from having 1 million more people in your region is to have a whole multimodal approach. And this is hard to read, but basically it says we have sort of scales of roads that are arterials, community roads, bike parkway. We now include bikes and walkways and footpaths as part of almost all of our transportation projects, I think all of them. What's the rail capacity, what's high-capacity transit, and then back out again. So we looked at a whole range of multimodal solutions to the congestion that we're concerned about. And we came up with the realization that in the old model, the motordom model, transportation kind of destroyed communities. It really, if you remember, a lot of our cities were carved up by freeways, and that's what Portland tried to prevent by ending the Mount Hood Freeway. What we found is that if we do it right, then the transportation can actually build the community. And nested in our regional transportation plan were a number of other plans, one of which I led, the high-capacity transit plan, which looked at, by high-capacity transit, we mean bus rapid transit, commuter rail, rapid streetcar, not just the local slow streetcar, but something that serves a sort of hybrid commuter role, and then light rail, which is kind of our premier form of transportation. We also did a freight study that's nested into our regional transportation plan. We did a study of the potential for technological solutions, like just signal timing to help us with, we call it TISMO, Transportation System Management Options, to help us with congestion. So we nested a whole lot of these other studies into our regional transportation plan. But of these, the one that will make the most sense in terms of building communities is the high-capacity transit plan. And as part of the high-capacity transit plan, we took on a real innovative approach to this. We went back out to our communities, and you can't really read this, but we asked them, what's important to you? We got their local aspirations. We actually had some software that we could sit down with the city planners, and we could say, okay, you want to have a light rail project here. Here's your density right now. You put in, in order to put in light rail, we need to have a certain amount of ridership to make it make sense, because it's a huge regional investment. And for your community to get that benefit, you have to absorb a lot of the regional density. So we'd say, okay, if you add some, like maybe if you upzoned to 3 or 4 stories, here's the density you'll have. And we could show them with this tool. So we were able to bring it out to our communities and actually work with them and show them how their communities could grow in order to accommodate or be sort of worthy of high-capacity transit. And we had 25 criteria that we used then coming out of that process, things like equity for low-income communities, ridership, environmental impacts. There's a whole list that we could do a kind of a, there's technical terms for how they did this, but it's a multi-phased evaluation approach to weighing different corridors. When we went out the first time, we had these open houses, and had everybody say, you know, where do you want light rail to be? And most people just think of it as light rail. Didn't do us any good to call it high-capacity transit. We pretty much had to say light rail. And we came back with what we called our spaghetti map. There were light rails everywhere. There was like something like 56 or 60 light rail lines. And we had to screen it down and get to a workable number. So we applied some of these criteria at sort of baser and then more fine detail until we got down to a set that looked pretty workable. And then we looked with our communities at what's the existing conditions in your community, what are your aspirations, what are the alternative futures you might be able to have, and how committed are you going to be able to, again, deserve that kind of huge regional investment. So it was really simultaneous planning going on, and I can assure you, our staff was just running crazy through this. This all went on. This piece of it was just last year. We spent 1 year on the high capacity transit study, and both our staff and the planners and the staffs in our various cities were just running around crazy because we tried to get it all the pieces together. But it worked, and we came up with this is the final map of the next 35 years of high-capacity transit in the Metro Portland region. The green lines are ranked as the most likely to be built in the near future. They're the ones that ranked highest for ridership, but also ranked very high for community commitment to helping to get things like that last mile, get the sidewalks in place so that as you build this light rail project, people can easily get to the stations. Through this process, we did a number of other innovative things. We created a think tank. It was the first time we'd done this at Metro, and I like to think this was my idea. But we brought in people like Gordon, only Gordon wasn't on it, but a local version of Gordon, Ethan Seltzer, and planners and big thinkers, as well as people who we knew were going to just throw thunderbolts at us if we got it wrong. So we had the critics at the table, and we just said, you know, we just want you to think about some of the issues and help us think about how a transit system builds communities. And we'd been saying, calling this our whole process making the greatest place, and they kept saying, well, no, it's making the greatest region. We need to really think of it as a regional thing. So this think tank really got us thinking away from the idea of transit corridors and into the idea of communities that happen to be linked by high-capacity transit. And thinking about the stations, not as transit stations, but as station areas. And thinking about what would you put at a station that would make it a totally walkable community. Because if you're going to invest in a light rail line and a light rail station, you really want to max out your investments in that area. So we looked at things like satellite campuses at a light rail station, or neighborhood clinics, or affordable housing, or not so affordable housing, a whole blend of coffee shops, dry cleaners, and people started sending us these lists. We had an online build a regional system that had about 6,000 hits during this public process. And people were saying, I want a light rail line here, and I want to be able to walk to this and this and this, and we had it linked to that neighborhood and what's there now and how they could walk around. So we really used this process not so much to get corridors, but to get communities and to show how they'd be linked. So on this map, the green ones are probably the priority corridors, and right here is the commuting. There it is, the community I'm going to talk about. I don't know how to go backwards. Does that go backwards? Here. Okay, so right here is a crossroads, and it's the city of Tigard. Tigard is one of the neighborhoods that we think can really become very urban. Out here, before I go on too far, the light rail project, the blue lines in here are existing light rail lines. There's one up here. There's one that goes up to the airport. This is the first one that goes into my district, my green line. The ones that are white are the ones that we're planning now, and this is really my line. This is the Portland-Milwaukee line. This is one I've worked on for 10 years. I got involved in politics, became a neighborhood leader to get this line into my community, and it has taken that long. So I'm very excited about that project. And then this one is the Lake Oswego streetcar line that's a hybrid. So these are in planning right now. But the next corridor we will be adopting on Thursday will be this line to Tigard. And I'll talk a little bit about that. When we built this line, this goes out to Hillsborough. And Hillsborough is somewhat like the Langleys. It's was a farming community, has become more and more urbanized. Right now I think they're at about 80,000 people and growing very quickly. It will be one of the industrial workhorses. It's one of the industrial workhorses of the whole state right now. It's where a lot of our high-tech industries have located. The big problem with how you grow out here for us, and it's one that is getting me bombarded with emails right now, is that this whole part of our region, this whole western part, it's all foundation farmland. And in order to build industries out here, we have to make the trade-off of some of the best topsoil in the United States, 7-foot-deep topsoil that can grow anything, versus nice, flat access to highway land for industries. And we're in the process right now of trying to make some decisions about how much we're willing to make that trade-off. The light rail was originally going to go all the way out here to this lovely community of Forest Grove, which might be the township of Langley or Fort Langley. It's only 6 miles from the end of the line, but it's a really expensive 6 miles. And right now, it doesn't have the ridership. So in the 1982 high-capacity transit plan, the Forest Grove, this is a community of Forest Grove. Forest Grove was like a top priority, as was mine, my Milwaukee line. And they kept getting put down and down and down on the line. When we did the last analysis, Forest Grove, unfortunately, dropped to the very bottom of the list. So if we were just going to go by data, which is sort of how this map got created, we have these green lines, which are the next priority. We have orange lines, which are looking pretty good. Yellow lines, which are looking pretty good, and they're all tiered based on how quickly we think we can bring them in. We said it's not enough to just go by data. This is where you'd get if you said ridership plus environmental impacts plus equity, a number of these things calculated out. We said the other piece that's really missing is that local readiness, that willingness of the communities to build around light rail. So the map is what got all the attention, but for my money, the most important thing that we've done in our region with high-capacity transit is called the system expansion policy, and that's what we will use to say, Forest Grove may be the furthest out, it may be down on the map, but boy, if Forest Grove gets its act together, it can move up that ladder, and some of that will be engaging in, can they create more jobs out there? Can they create more density out there? Are there things that community can do to be able to get a high-capacity transit line? Because it's really about, again, how do you build that community? Are you ready? Are you willing to be a a light rail, excuse me, or a rapid streetcar community that's willing to put your community investment in to match the regional investment, because that's how we have to fund these things. We have some federal money, we have some local money, we have regional money, and it all has to go together, and it all has to make sense to our taxpayers all around the region. So let me tell you about Tigard. And then I'll wrap up with just a little case study of how all these multitude of planning processes came together into one community. And Tigard is a good one because Tigard has wanted light rail and has wanted to be an urban density community and has been willing to do the homework. And so we actually have been working very closely with them. When we did our transportation planning, we broke it into two tracks. And again, this is how you do land use and transportation together. We had the regional and state mobility track, which is kind of in our version, it's ODOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation, has its highway standards. It's like the book that you showed. How do we sort of comply with their standards, which we don't? And I'll talk a little bit more about that. We've pretty much said we're not going to make roads that just so that traffic's the most important thing in our region anymore. We're not going to do it. But we talked about investments that are multimodal. So we had a whole transportation track, but the other track of this planning process was the community building piece, and that's the investments that the community makes and that we make in the community to have these two work together. So in downtown Tigard, on my left, and well, I guess they're on both sides. The piece on the left is the existing Tigard, and as you can see, it's crisscrossed by major highways. The piece on the right is what Tigard hopes to be become, and this is their downtown. Right now, there's sort of old town downtown Tigard, and this large, see if I can follow the little line here. This is a major, major state highway. This is a major highway. So they're really in the middle of a ton of traffic. And what I love about their future plan is that they build up all this density, but you might notice they have a lot more green space. They're actually going to be relying a lot more. This is Fennel Creek, and they're going to be expanding the Fennel Creek green space, taking out some of the less useful development along it and create a much more integrated set of bike commuter. We call it active transportation. They'll have bike commuter and trails, and they'll connect up with our regional intertwine, which is our region-wide set of trails and bike paths. So they've really looked at a vision that, while being more dense, is also more green. And I think Vancouver has taught us that you can do density as long as you give people places to breathe and views and green spaces to go to. It's a really critical part of the package that not every community gets right. Manhattan, if it didn't have Central Park, would, I think, fail completely as an urban community. Although its transit system is really enviable. I love Manhattan. One of the first things we did was identify the constraints, and they're pretty similar most places. Funding, market, meaning getting the developers to invest in this community. Parking, in this case, too much parking, and how do you get it down, and how do you get it into structure so that it's not sprawled over your whole landscape. Connectivity, how do you get people to the stations if we build this light rail project? How do you get the neighborhoods to be connecting? How do you get sidewalk connectivity? This is a big push in all of our communities. Now, a lot of our communities were resistant to sidewalks because they felt it made them feel more small town, and now they're realizing that their kids can't get to school safely because they can't walk. So we're all pushing towards getting more sidewalk and bike connectivity. Access to the two major transportation networks here are Interstate 5 and Oregon 217. Traffic congestion. If you tried to drive through Tigard on an afternoon, you would be cursing the entire way. It is bumper to bumper. The mobility standards, that's that transportation criteria piece that Gordon was talking about, where the Oregon Department of Transportation says, yeah, you know, you can do all this density stuff, but don't make any of our roads fail. Well, hello, you can't do the kind of density we want to do without adding traffic unless you add in the transit component. And so we really, that's why it's got to be a piece of the puzzle. And then the potential growth in neighboring communities is a constraint because some of the other communities either want to grow more and want some of the growth or do not want to grow and do not want to be impacted by the traffic or other growth of Tigard. Highway 99W is a particular one problem for us because it's the busiest five-lane arterial highway in the state, carries about 50,000 vehicles a day, and goes right down the middle of Tigard. I actually, when I was a transportation consultant, one of the things that isn't in my resume there is I did a lot of transportation consulting, and one of the projects was called the Newburgh-Dundee Bypass, and it was to bypass Highway 99W because from Tigard all the way out, it is just bumper to bumper, and it's a very difficult traffic problem for the region. And so what Tigard has been saying is give us light rail in that corridor, not necessarily on Highway 99W, but in that corridor to take some of that traffic off of 99W. So that was probably the biggest constraint that we looked at overall. It was the one that is going to be the biggest problem because, again, we're dealing with our Department of Transportation, and they have their levels of mobility standards that they want us to keep. So going back to the two tracks, we had the transportation track. One of the things we did as part of our regional transportation plan, and how am I doing here? I'm running out of time, aren't I? One of the things that we did was we did a mobility atlas, and I was really impressed with this. And as people started to drill into it, they were all impressed. We took 24 corridors. We divided the whole region into 24 major corridors, and we said, what kind of traffic is coming and going? And if you looked at the mobility map for the city of Tigard, there's so much traffic. There is such a mesh of traffic going through there. All the rides that come from anywhere else in the region and go through that city are in our mobility atlas. And not just the cars, but the freight trucks, and if there's a large bicycle community, what's the business community like? What's the land use like? We did a really detailed analysis of every single corridor for this corridor atlas, and that helped us set priorities for Tigard of what we can do and what we can't do, frankly. The community building piece of it, again, the other side of that two-track system, was we looked with Tigard at their planning process and talked about getting the transit service, getting it into the right places, looking at street connectivity, looking at boulevard retrofits to, again, narrow down and be able to slow down some of the traffic. It's not always about moving traffic more quickly. What are the sidewalk, bike trail opportunities? And freight access is a huge one. So as our planning process now is wrapping up, we've got the local aspirations, Tigard's plan, what they want to see, and then what's in the current regional transportation plan are some of the elements of that, but not all of them. The one that's not on this list is the one, as I said, that's going to be adopted in the next couple of days, and that's that Barbara will be our next high-capacity corridor for the next light rail project, or it may not be light rail, it may be some other form, but it is the next one we're going to be studying. So this is just, I just wanted to give you a sense of how it actually works on the ground. As you can tell, it's a very complicated process, and being at Metro, being a regional government, we're only as successful as our local governments and our partnerships with our local governments, and it's all a day-to-day give and take, hard struggle, but creative process to get to the kinds of regional answers to local problems like Tigard has, and like you have out here in the Langleys. So thank you, and all of this is on our Metro website as well, and I think we're going to have a panel so we can for questions and answers, right? Okay, great.
Right, so if the panel would actually like to come and join me, that would be great. And thank you, Councillor Collette, again. That was great. Maybe while the panel's coming, I'll just say a couple. I'll give a quick plug for South Fraser On Track. One thing about South Fraser On Track that I really respect and am grateful for is that they're a very forward-thinking group. Unfortunately, in municipal government, in any level of government, they don't issue you a time machine when you take your oath of office, so you can't go back in time and change decisions that have already been made. But you do get the opportunity to work going forward. And one thing that's been great about the on-track folks is that, every budget cycle in the Township of Langley, the sustainability charter we put together, they came to the table willingly. They wanted to be involved. They wanted to offer their expertise and advice. And we're really grateful for their help and support and work with the Township. So just a little plug for that. I'm not being paid to moderate, so... That is a free plug right there. I just want to introduce two more panelists who are joining us. At the far end of the table is Jason Chu, who's a strategic planner with the Township of Langley. He was the guy who helped us shepherd through the Sustainability Charter Initiative in the township. Jason holds a Bachelor of Environmental Studies and a Master of Arts in Regional Planning and Resource Development. He's a full member of the Canadian Institute of Planners and has served as an elected counselor of the Planning Institute of BC between 2003 and 2009. And to his left is Paul Cordero, who is our Manager of Transportation and Engineering at the Township. He's been in that position since 2005. Before coming to Langley, he has worked in Canada and the U.S. for private and public organizations, including the City of Winnipeg Bridge Department, Manitoba Department of Highways, Canadian Department of National Defense, University of Manitoba Transportation Research Group, North Dakota, Reed Middleton in Seattle, and then he got saved and came to Langley away from Manitoba. So they're going to be here as well to answer questions. So we have about half an hour for questions. There is a mic kind of in the middle of the two sections there. So if you have a question, feel free to come forward and ask. If you want to address it to a specific person, you can. That would be great. I'll ask the first question, and it's one that kind of reflects the unique nature of Langley within the region. And Gordon, maybe you want to go first. What about the rural area of Langley? I mean, this is something that obviously the city of Vancouver had, you know, didn't have the same issues with. Yeah, well, exactly. You filled in False Creek. But, you know, if you look at the rural nature of Langley, yes, we are densifying along the 200 Street corridor, but, you know, Aldergrove, Fort Langley, Murrayville, you know, it seems like urban sprawl, but really we're just trying to work within an urban containment boundary in a lot of those areas. So maybe you could comment a little bit on the agricultural. There you go.
Well, you know, you touched on something so important, Jordan, and Patrick Condon said the same thing. South of the Fraser has so much more opportunity to do right what Vancouver did so wrong. You know, we were late in the Industrial Revolution in the 1890s, so, you know, a worldview that simply couldn't comprehend that it would be maybe a bad thing to turn False Creek into an industrial sewer and pretty much exploit the resource space in a way that we will actually never recover from. Now, we've had some real advantages, also some great foresight. But as Patrick was saying, you have now this fortuitous circumstance of having benefited from the most important land use decision ever made in British Columbia, the preservation of the agricultural land reserve, a very high priority to maintain your natural assets, certainly your opportunities to do some remarkable things. So that is a really good news story. But you are in this very dynamic tension built around motordom and having I think there's no question the most powerful land shaping mechanism that we've ever had, which was building freeways, building infrastructure on a scale that human beings have never done before. And how you resolve that is what makes this place so fascinating to watch. But I, as you can tell from my presentation, it's a tough dynamic that you're in here.
Should I add anything on the agricultural or? No? Okay. You don't have the app. No, fair enough. Councillor Steve Ferguson from the Township has a question.
Yeah, I don't have divine intervention, Jordan, like yourself. But I, you know, Colette, I actually spend a lot of time in Oregon. I love Oregon. In fact, I spent a little bit of time at the University of Oregon, the Ducks. And I always get lost in Portland, which is, especially when you had a lot of infrastructure you're building, I didn't think you were ever going to finish. Crossing that bridge, I think I got stuck quite a few times. But my question is to Mr. Rossi, believe it or not, is that there seems to be, and you'll help me out if I'm wrong, a disconnect or disjoint between a regional planning and a regional plan and a regional transportation plan. And that keeps coming up again and again and again. How do we get everybody together where we have a contiguous plan that works both as a land use and a transportation use? And maybe some of the other folks can jump in as well. That's my question.
The work that we're doing on our frequent transit network, which incorporates all levels of transit service, really tries to respond to the regional plan and to the community plans within the region. And that is really exactly what we're trying to do through the development of a frequent transit network.
Now, the reason why I'm asking, if Johnny Carlisle from the regional district was here, he would say there's a lot of conflict between what you guys are doing and what they're trying to do within their regional plan.
I can't comment really on what Mr. Carlisle said about that. I do know that with our work, we work directly from the regional plan. With our own planning, try and respond to that plan and respond to how the communities themselves are growing in response to that plan. We are having conversations with the regional district and with the communities that we work in, trying to help them understand some of the difficulties that are associated with providing transit around some of the land use patterns that exist and some of them that are evolving, and we're trying to, you know, to have that conversation go two ways so that we can shape the decisions on both sides. But we are very much involved in responding to the regional plan.
Okay, thank you. Can you give any specifics there? I'm wondering where Johnny thought the disconnect was.
Well, Gordon, you've been around a long time. I mean, we have centers in Langley. There's centers in Surrey. If you went around and interviewed folks who lived in the area, they'd say, you know, why should I use transit? It's not reliable. It's not something that is frequent enough. It's not something that connects me from community to community. And where TransLink or transit folk want to take somebody to is not where somebody wants to go. It's a large region. There's a lot of people going in the region, where the actual money is put in transit is not necessarily the best way.
This is about money, though. It's not about the plan.
Well,
I can maybe clarify. Metro Vancouver has made it clear to us within their regional planning strategy process this time. The draft, as you've seen it, is only a few pages dealing with transportation as compared to many other issues within the region. When we met, when Township Council met with members of Metro Vancouver staff to work through some of our concerns, one of our concerns was, where's the transit plan? Because as we've been talking about, the best transit plan is a land use plan. So we have this land use plan, but the transit plan was separate. And I think that's where some of the disconnect was coming in. Johnny did say that the two staffs are working well together, TransLink and Metro Vancouver, but not at the level where they, not at the political level where they want to put it forward as part of the regional strategy.
But just to clarify, do you think that the transit corridors, the commitments to various forms of rail, the frequent transit network, there's something wrong there, or you're just not going to get it fast enough?
I think there's some strong philosophical differences between what transit is, and some of the folk that are even sponsoring this event today are talking about light rail, some of the stuff that they got in, believe it or not, in Portland. You know, that we'd like to see a bit of that out here throughout the region. We'd like to see, the use of the corridors, the rail corridors. And, there's another thing that hasn't been mentioned, where heavy rail dominates as much as your motor things. There's lots of rails stopping cars and other things as well. But I thought that the one question. Other people want to speak as well.
Maybe I'll rephrase the question. And I guess the Port Moody Newport Village experience is an example of a community that went wholesale into density and have done it well. And you're absolutely correct. Beautiful density, beautiful buildings. It's working. Everything's working except the transit network. And you have a mayor who now will not vote for further density within that community because it's gridlock. And despite hiding the cars underground, people still have to use their cars. And it's not TransLink's fault. It's, three levels of government, four levels of government maybe, who haven't been able to connect on the cost sharing for the Evergreen line. So the fear for people in Langley, I think, many people in Langley, not everyone, but fear for quite a few people, would be, okay, you go and build an urban village like Newport Village, you do the hard decisions, you do the tough planning, what's the guarantee that there is going to be the rapid transit necessary to facilitate, to take care of those people? Otherwise, we're just dumping more people onto 200th Street and other places. And, you know, I don't think any of us have the answers, but...
Well, it's about the money. It's about the money. Who's going to tax? Who's going to pay? Well, the tough questions. I'm not being facile about this, but that's always what it's been about. I do think there's a difference, you know, in terms of using the Southern BC Rail alignment. I think that's a really important debate to have. But so what? There's no money. Until we come to terms with that, we're in this obscene position here of inviting the world and upscaling transit. And what are we going to do the day after the Olympics are over? Mothball the third C bus, shut down even the rapid bus systems that we're going to. We should be embarrassed. And the very fact that TransLink voted for the $130 million, and that's the last we've heard of it, and as far as I know, inform me otherwise, if there's any serious discussion happening in Victoria about how we're even going to do just the basics of the plan.
Well, Gordon.
Well, what's going on?
Your Worship, maybe you could go to the mic here. Mayor Green is a member of the Mayor's Council, not on the TransLink board. I'm sure he'd like me to clarify.
Definitely not on the TransLink board. I think, Gordon, what happened? I mean, we were caught in the choice of hanging or the electric chair.
Absolutely.
Okay, and that's what it was. We had three choices. The commissioner did not permit the fourth choice. So we had a $270 million where we're going to have a vehicle levy. Well, I can tell you, Jordan knows and anybody out here knows, if we ever to impose a vehicle levy, Gordon, it would be a very, very quick political career,
absolutely,
let me tell you. And the reality is, I mean, you know, Jordan knows this. I had Jordan come out, we made a presentation to the TransLink board. And we had Maple Ridge, Langley City, Langley Township make a presentation. And the idea is this educational session, well, the TransLink board will understand what all of our problems are out here. Well, I thought it was a real eye-opener, Jordan, and I think you would agree.
Absolutely.
These folks didn't have a clue what our problems were. They didn't know that we didn't have bus service into Gloucester, one of our major industrial estates. They didn't know that it took students, post-secondary students, 2.5 hours a day, one way, to get to post-secondary institutions, some. You know, we're caught between a rock and a hard place. We voted for the $130 million because the other choice was we get transit services cut by 40%. We go back like 25 years, and it was going to start within a week because TransLink's virtually broke, and that was the line that we were on. So now we've gone back. We voted for the $130 million, which we said is a temporary measure. The plan is we're going to have this revisited in about an eight-month time frame because negotiations are going on now. There's a staff working council, and the provincial government have, through the ministry, have promised to come to the table because we've got to find some sustainable funding because none of this is going to work until we do. Their answer was put it on the property tax. Well, I can tell you. I mean... We all know we're being a little bit parochial out here, but you know what? It's about time we did.
Absolutely. You made the right decision. You made the only decision. You shouldn't have had that decision to make.
Next question.
My name's Luke. I live in New Westminster, and I work in Surrey. I just would like to illustrate two things that have been happening here recently. We had... Last summer, the Royal Hudson on one weekend do two trips from New Westminster to Cloverdale, which demonstrates that we already have rail capacity from New Westminster to Cloverdale. But that was a one weekend thing, and it was like $100 or something ridiculous just to, you know, joyride on a train. I'm currently volunteering downtown with Bombardier in the city of Vancouver for the Olympic Line project. I'm going to get to drive these lovely new trains from Cambie Street to Granville Island. something that in all likelihood these beautiful cars are going to be returned to Belgium, you know, within two short months. I understand this whole planning that's necessary for long-term growth and projects, but there's some existing rail corridors and some existing technology that we could have trains right now. And isn't there some argument for saying build the rail with what we have and the density will follow? Because everything I've heard here is about we need to create the density in order to justify the cost of the rail. We're spending $3 to $4 billion, I don't know the exact number, to expand Gateway, which we all in this room probably agree is not the greatest use of our money. But for only a fraction of that money, $200 million, you could have that Bombardier car wrapped from Granville Island all the way around downtown, through downtown core and say out to Stanley Park, or connect to the new SkyTrain line at VCC Clark, or have some diesel power, a single car diesel car, go from New Westminster to Cloverdale on an existing line that exists right now and is essentially underused. So anyway, I don't know if you guys would like to comment on that, but there's opportunities right here, right now. And it is, again, like Gordon says, it's a question of political will for funding.
Did Portland have any experience with repurposing rail lines or reusing rail lines?
Yeah, we did, actually. There we go. One of our only commuter rail line is called West Side Express Service or something like that, and it was repurposing an existing rail line. In theory, it could have been a really good idea. It turned out that it ended up costing a lot more. The rail lines weren't as compatible as we had thought. There were delays. I mean, I think we learned a lot that will make it better the next time around. We're looking at the line from the end of the light rail line in Hillsborough that I showed you out to that community in Forest Grove. We're looking at that 6 miles might be a good application of something like a commuter line because there is an existing rail corridor. And we might be able to just tie right into that. And actually, Forest Grove is practically willing to pay for it on their own just to get transit out there because they feel it's going to be so important for them in order to densify. It's not always just because there's a rail line that it's going to be really easy. It does tend to be cheaper, though, and West is probably not a very good example because we had a number of complications. We're going to be looking at more, and West is... we're going to be actually upgrading West's frequency now so that it serves not just as a morning and evening commuter line, but as a much more of a frequent line. Since it's built, we might as well get more use out of it. But there are issues of compatibility with the rail, compatibility with the other uses like freight, things like that that we've had to contend with that we didn't quite have as much experience with as we do with light rail. So it didn't go as smoothly as we'd hoped.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, this is a question for Councillor Collette. I lived in Portland for 8 months 10 years ago. Very nice city. I enjoyed it. And you have, it's called the MAX, which is a surface light rail system. And I was really impressed. It was much better than our SkyTrain when I rode it then. So these new systems that you're looking at, would they be, again, sort of light rail, surface rail, or would you consider something like a SkyTrain that we've done here, and your reasons why?
We're not considering SkyTrain. It's so expensive. The corridor that we just are about to approve, the Tigard Corridor, it's also called the Barber Corridor because it goes along Barber Boulevard, we'll probably have to do some tunneling for that, which will get fairly expensive as well. But the MAX system is our major light rail system. It's the one that goes east-west now. It goes north and south and out to the airport. And it's been the most cost-effective system for us. We've been pretty successful with it. We're not, even on this Tigard project, we're not calling it light rail. We're not narrowing it down and saying light rail is what we're going to build. What we're saying is we're going to do some form of high-capacity transit, partly because in some communities light rail is really welcome and people, you know, the mayors are lining up and begging for it. Other communities, light rail is a big piece of infrastructure to put into a community, and there's fear about it, and you know, fear that it'll bring crime or whatever. So on that corridor, we'll do an alternatives analysis, and we'll figure out what is the best mode. And it's most likely going to be light rail. Like the Lake Oswego project that I mentioned is actually streetcar, and it's partly because it's a pretty constrained corridor, and it doesn't really have the higher capacity need that light rail requires. Light rail really serves where you have major density, where you've got great ridership. That's the vehicle of choice for our region. We haven't really, we brought a group up here, and I don't mean to disparage your SkyTrain system, but we come up here quite frequently. We bring our mayors up here to Port Moody and some of the other communities, and when we looked at the SkyTrain, we liked the notion that it has a smaller footprint, but it's so expensive. The infrastructure is so expensive.
Thank you. Mr. Price, you mentioned Patrick Condon a few minutes ago, and I was wondering if you could just briefly mention the study he did that where the, was it the $1 billion for the South Fraser Perimeter Freeway would give 200 kilometers of light rail in Langley and Surrey? If you could just briefly mention that. Thank you.
You did a nice job of summing it up. But I would note that there hasn't been a major transit line in the Lower Mainland that I can think of, Expo, Millennium, and Canada Line, the proposal to UBC, the Evergreen Line, that the region hasn't suggested it should be light rail. That hasn't been overruled. The province and the feds just simply come to an agreement with mechanisms I've sometimes never understood. No, we're paying the bill on this, and it's going to be SkyTrain. So we maybe get a system once every decade. And if we had gone with the original regional plan, there would be light rail operating today here. But that's the decisions that get made by those who are paying the capital costs, although increasingly, of course, they're requiring TransLink to be at the table. And I don't see that changing. Same thing happened with Evergreen. The MP there wants the biggest toy, I guess. I mean, I believe there's something I call the BLT school of transportation planning. Boys love trains. And well, boys of both genders, I have to say, but by and large, it's been boys. And you know, that is facetious, but there's a lot to it, and I don't see that changing. In this region, they want to go for the big buck, but there's very limited amount of big buck to do it with.
I think Patrick Condon had a study as well that said that you could buy every student at UBC for 50 years a brand new Prius every year, for the same cost of putting the underground SkyTrain line on Broadway.
Yeah, which I doubt will happen.
No,
I'm not even sure where we're studying it, to be honest. The idea that you're going to run anything through Point Grey.
Councillor Collette.
I just wanted to comment on, I think my saying that the next corridor will be this 99 corridor, the Barber-Tigard line, it is competitive in the United States. We do get somewhere between 50% and 60% of the projects are underwritten by the federal government, and then the local community has to come up with the remaining amount. And we in the metro region, because we were kind of the first to do this, starting in 1982, to do a new whole light rail system, we've had a project funded every time we've gone for it. There's no guarantee that that's going to be the case in the future. So we have to be much more, that's partly why we have the system expansion policy. We have to be much more grounded, much more realistic about local support for those projects, just in order to get into the pipeline with the federal government to get any money. The new transportation authorization law that's coming out has been tabled now for a few more months, but it actually will credit communities for if they can, depending on how big a match they can put in. Well, almost every other state in the United States has sales tax, and they raise sales taxes in order to fund their light rail projects. We don't have sales tax in Oregon, so y'all come shopping down there. but that means that we don't have the flexible funding source. We use lottery funds. We use, you know, whatever we can cobble together from our communities in order to fund our local match on these projects.
A payroll tax?
We have a payroll tax that's the operating cost for the transit system. The other thing I wanted to add, it's sort of a question, is TransLink your only transit? Because in the metro region, when people got upset about TriMet, which is our big transportation mogul, They formed smaller ones. The city of Sandy formed its own transit system, and I was just with the mayor the other day, and she said, we're celebrating 10 years without TriMet, and we couldn't be happier. And the South Metro area around Wilsonville formed their own transit authority, and they have what's called SMART, the SMART South Metro area, something or other. And they're quite happy with their transit system. So I don't know if it's I don't know if it's not allowed up here, but that's how people in some communities, outlying communities in Oregon, if they weren't happy with the transit system, they just said, okay, we're out of here. We'll form our own.
Yeah. TransLink has a legislative monopoly in this region.
If I could inject a minute, Carlotta, could you briefly speak about job creation, the figures that you found with job creation with rail versus...
with transit in general, as Gordon mentioned, that everybody's economy crashed at the end of 2008, and in the U.S., the administration sent out a ton of money to local communities for job creation, stimulus dollars, they were called. We were told not to call them stimulus dollars, recovery money. Or so. I can't remember what the jargon of the day was. The analysis of that, the payback in terms of jobs, is that there were two jobs created for every investment of stimulus dollars in transit versus roads. So we had twice the job creation from investments in transit. And what we've heard back from the administration is that bodes very well for the next round of stimulus dollars. In our region, we're actually looking at how to create kind of a green package that we'll take to the administration to get stimulus dollars to do some of the last mile issues of how do you get connected to a transit station so that people don't have to drive. We'll do some projects like that. They have to be shovel ready, which is a little bit difficult. We've gotten quite a bit of stimulus money for our streetcars that are in construction right now. But some of our light rail planning is a little bit further down. We won't necessarily be able to get shovel-ready money for that, but 2-to-1. Two jobs for every dollar invested compared to dollars invested in roads.
Leo.
Oh, good evening. My name is Leo Matrunin, and I live on 200 Street in Willoughby. I'd like to ask a question that relates to something maybe more positive, and that's on the local level, as opposed to the complexities of the regional questions we've been trying to solve. But I'd like to go back to what Councillor Collette said earlier, especially about creating a vibrant, walkable community, and about placemaking. I think that's so critical. We have such opportunities now to do that. So my question goes to planning. Does the township have projects existing or coming forward that focus on community building and placemaking and vibrant, walkable communities? Thank you.
We actually have some projects that are ongoing that are basically on the board, so to speak. We're working with two communities in particular to create walkable communities. One is the Central Gordon area. We're basically following the walkability index to create some commercial nodes within that neighborhood, although that neighborhood is relatively small compared to other neighborhoods that we have built in the Willoughby area. So the simple answer is yes, we do have initiatives and a focus on building walkable communities.
And Aldergrove.
And sure, thank you, Councillor. And also, how can I forget Aldergrove?
It's his life.
We're also working on the Aldergrove core planning, basically trying to look at ways to revitalize the downtown core of Aldergrove. And we're basically trying to, again, add more density to the core area, as well as creating mixed-use opportunities within the downtown core.
I really appreciate the Aldergrove plan and really the vision of that. Since I live in Willoughby, I just thought maybe you only had one example, Yorkson Estates, for example, or any other than...
Obviously, Yorkson is off the planning board already because we're moving into implementation phase. And in fact, we have received development applications for the Yorkson core area. And the Yorkson core area, for those who are not familiar, will be the downtown core for the Willoughby community. and we have applications for a multi-phase residential development. And on the other side of the street on 80th Avenue, and then now it's basically talking about the southwest corner of 80th and 208th, we have applications for almost like Newport Village kind of development, but that will be built over a span of, I believe, 10 to 15 years, depending on market conditions.
We have only about 10 minutes left, so I'm going to go to the next question.
Excuse me, Jordan. Oh. Can I just normally with South Fraser on Track, we add in all of our meetings on time because we're respective of your time. So by a show of hands, are there people here that are willing to allow this to go till 9:10? Can I have a show of hands for those interested? Great. Thank you very much.
Come on.
My question is for Councillor Collette. How important has it been to have a directly elected directly elected board mm-hmm. be responsible for the transit and land use planning and in terms of the present and future success of the rapid transit in the Portland region? And maybe thinking of it in other terms, what would it look like today and in the future without such a directly elected board overseeing the process?
Well, I think it's great. I love what I do. I think the important thing that the role that the Metro Council plays is that each of the local leaders, and we have these two advisory committees, the Metro Policy Advisory Committee and the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, and I chair the Transportation Committee, and they're kind of, they're volunteers, but they're local government leaders. If all the decisions, what happens at those meetings is that that tends to be where you hash it out, and there's some, you know, community biases, and it really, the Metro Council kind of runs the debate and helps to bring things to completion and helps to force the issues and ultimately makes the decisions. We rarely disagree with those two advisory committees, and actually we're partners with the JPAC, the Transportation Committee, partners with Metro much more closely than the other committee. That committee's advisory, this committee is really part of the decision-making entity with us. But I think without a regionally elected council whose sole job it is to do this regional planning, the interests would tend to be more parochial, and there would be more debates. I mean, if we had a good example is Forest Grove. When we finished the high-capacity transit plan, we presented it to the various advisory committees for their approval. And the mayor of Forest Grove, who has fought for over a decade to get light rail to his community, said, "You know, I'm heartbroken because of where my project ended up on this plan, but you did such a great regional plan that I'm going to vote no, but I'm going to vote because it's my city, but I want all the rest of you to vote yes because it's a great plan." And to me, that was about as good a validation as you could possibly get for a regional planning entity, that we were able to say it's not like wheeling and dealing. It's really what's the regional value. And I think what tends to happen if you've got, and this may not be at all true for Vancouver Metro, and I apologize if I'm making casting aspersions, but you tend to have sort of a different kind of deal making, where you say, okay, you can have yours this year, but I want mine next year. And with the regional government, we can say, no, the real deal for the region is to do it this way, this way, this way. These are the priorities that make sense for the region. And it's not about making deals. It's about having this broader perspective. It doesn't always work, but I think we're actually getting better at it. We're dealing with much tougher issues, with the oil issues and the economy and the lack of money. It's getting much more difficult, but I think in some ways having the regional body is even more effective now because we do make those decisions at a higher, you know, the 30,000-foot level in a way. And we do tons of analysis that the local governments wouldn't necessarily be able to make.
So the last two gentlemen in line, you'll be our last two speakers. So
I know this is an anti-SkyTrain audience, but Mr. Price was talking about building freeways years ago. Well, we decided not to build freeways. Let's go to rapid transit. Well, it seems today now the answer is don't build freeways, but don't build anything else either. It seems to me that senior governments want to put the least amount of money ever into transit. So I really don't know how you expect to have a transit system when there seems to be less willingness to put money into it. And I would just simply think that this is a combination of betrayal of the public and abdication of responsibility. So that's how I feel.
Well, clearly government is prepared to put money, as the Canada Line illustrates.
Well, you can bet your bottom dollar it would cost you in the billions to punch a freeway through from Richmond into downtown Vancouver, yet we hear people snibbling about spending $2 billion to build a Canada Line as though somehow or other, why should we be spending this kind of money on transportation? That really galls me. Mm-hmm.
And our final question.
Yes, Gordon Price. I'd like to know, if you're going to densify an area, like, say, have a lot more office towers instead of office parks out in the valley that sprawl all over the place, what kind of floor-to-space ratios do you need to allow developers to, you know, encourage them to make these big investments in new office? Because, you know, they're not going to do it if you just allow them an extra story, you know, to redevelop an area. Don't you have to allow them a much bigger floor-to-space ratio?
Boy, it depends. You know, I don't think there's any general answer to that. And I would tend to say that it probably isn't really just a function of density. You would have to give me a pretty good indication of the part of the region you're talking about, what kind of job base you're referencing here, what other kind of mixes might be involved, land values, so many factors.
Okay, because I think that's a problem.
You can't even make a mistake of having too high densities. Very often you might actually just simply freeze the land, the owner waiting until the market is ready to take advantage of densities that may not even be remotely achievable until perhaps another generation. Lower it, and they're much more likely to develop.
Okay.
So again, I just can't give you any generality on that.
Okay. Because I think that's the problem we have in this region, that there's just too much, you know, Gloucester Industrial Estates way out at 264th and the freeway, that's way too far out. We should be developing in, say, East Burnaby around the SkyTrain. I just wonder how we encourage developers to do that.
Yeah. Well, so long as, of course, we have a motordom-based system, and I include trucks in that, they're going to be making criteria that really just simply don't take into account anything that requires higher land values or anything that doesn't allow for that simple form to exist. And they'll basically be looking for the closest interchange.
And with that, we're going to turn it back to Nathan. But on behalf of the panel, I think we'd all agree that we'd like to thank Nathan and Joe and South Fraser on Track for having us. And Nathan's going to make some closing comments.
Sure, and I have another question here before I do a closing comment for Paul. Maybe he can comment about the big transportation planning book that Gordon had up on the slide and what the Township of Langley is doing and if they necessarily follow that book or do other things.
It feels kind of weird being on this side of the table, but I'll try and answer this. We do have a copy of that big book. Every transportation guy does. Again, it's a guide. I think Gordon said something that really hit home for me anyway. It's where we have to live in reality, and we have to look at what's viable and what the vast majority of people are actually doing right now. And we have to accommodate the car. Again, I don't think that we build just for the car. And what the township has been doing, I think, fairly successfully the last few years is building more of our roads in terms of a multimodal, walkable type of facility. You'll notice bike lanes, large sidewalks, a lot more green space, and encouraging other types of modes to actually at least be possible. Not to say that we still are a suburb, and the harsh reality is that we're still primarily car-oriented here. So it's we're trying to accommodate all modes, but again, we don't control transit here. That is TransLink, and I think the biggest issue is the money, like what Gordon has said.
Thank you.
So
panel. Our panelists also, I guess Jordan's turned this back on again. Okay, our moderator, also our speakers, and I'd like to thank our elected officials that took time out of their day to show up here, and also all of you for coming out. Just wanted to do a couple housekeeping items. The audio from this meeting will be posted up on our blog probably within the next 2 or 3 days, so you can visit that at southfraser.net, southfraser.net. We'll also probably post up some pictures as well. We'd like to again thank the generosity of the Township of Langley Mayor and Council for supporting this by giving us money to put on this event. We'd like to do this again in the future in the Township of Langley again with the support of Mayor and Council. I think it's a great opportunity to have this kind of event and also look at Langley. We have the township, which is sort of a greenfield area, and how we can do sustainable building in the greenfield development, which is interesting. And yet on the other hand, we have the city of Langley, which is sort of that area where we get to redevelop. And I sure would love to have another thing like this with the support of the city of Langley and mayor and council to look at how we can build and redevelop and talk about the downtown Langley plan as well. Also, if you'd like, you can also financially support us. You can either speak to Joe or myself or visit our blog again at southfraser.net. I think that pretty much sums it up. I want to thank you. Have yourself a great evening.